This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A car bomb killed four today in Fallujah. An American soldier was killed in Baghdad. A newspaper editor shot dead in Mosul. Yesterday, a horrific series of coordinated suicide attacks in Baghdad, explosions at the headquarters of the Red Cross and at four Iraqi police stations, left dozens dead and hundreds injured. And all that followed Sunday's bold multiple rocket attack on the Al Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. And we heard today that a Baghdad deputy mayor was assassinated in a drive-by shooting over the weekend, too. In a few minutes, we'll talk with terrorism experts about who could be behind these attacks and their ideas about the best way to deal with the violence. But first, here in Washington, President Bush called a news conference this morning, the 10th since he took office and the first in almost 3 months, where he answered a barrage of questions about Iraq. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR Senior at Washington Editor Ron Elving. And Ron, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Neil.
Did the president have anything new to say at his press conference today?
No, there was not any new information in the president's remarks, and there was not a new approach or even a new angle or tack to be taken on any of this information. The president did not go back to Monday's remark that the bombings showed how much progress was being made. Rather, he returned to the more established policy statements regarding where this is coming from, the hatred of freedom, the nature of terrorism. And he reminded the nation that he has been saying Iraq is a very dangerous place.
The president had his manner today was different. He came across to many observers as, well, rather flat.
I thought it was interesting that at the very beginning of the press conference, he observed that he had just returned from a lengthy trip to Asia a few days ago. He said to the reporters who had been with him on that trip, "I hope you had a restful weekend." Strong implication that he had not had one, of course, for all the reasons that we've already cited. There was an indication that the president was perhaps burdened, perhaps somewhat disheartened, although I'm sure he would reject that observation, but that he was bearing all of this bad news very close to his heart and to his mind, and that there did not seem to be a good and easy way to push it away.
Well, let's listen to an example of what we're talking about. This is an excerpt of the president's opening statement where he said that the world is a safer place today after the fall of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, where he vowed the United States will stay the course, and where he cited international support.
Last week at a donor conference in Madrid brought together more than 70 nations to discuss future contributions to Iraqi reconstruction. America appreciates the recent announcements of financial commitments to Iraq offered by many of the donors at the conference. After decades of oppression and brutality in Iraq and Afghanistan, reconstruction is difficult, and freedom still has its enemies in both of those countries. These terrorists are targeting the very success and freedom we're providing to the Iraqi people.
Ron Elving, it's been often observed that the president may not be at his best during a give and take of news conferences. This, though, an opening statement that he read. If the goal today was to reinvigorate the message, to combat the bad news of the continued violence, do you think he had much success?
I don't think that he breathed a lot of new life into the message. He has, of course, given these very lines many times before, and it is difficult to come out under these circumstances and do so. But one might have expected that if you're going to go to the trouble of setting up a rather unusual news conference, as you say, he's had one of these about once every 3 months in his presidency, that you would bring forth a little bit more of a salesman's enthusiasm for the message.
This is one of several steps the administration has taken in recent days to get its message out about the positive developments in Iraq. The president met with regional broadcasters earlier this month, going over the head, if you will, of the White House news press corps. This past weekend, he sent out high-ranking cabinet members to the Sunday talk shows, Secretary of State Powell, for example. Now, the news conference, what else can he do at this point?
Well, if the goal is to reinvigorate the presentation of policy, then I would think that one of the things they might do would be to become much more aggressive and assertive about saying that for the news media to continue to dwell on the negative is unpatriotic and that it's doing a disservice to America. And we might hear some of that, at least around the edges. Secondly, they could change policy. They could return to the United Nations with a different tone and ask for help in a different way. They could possibly make funds available for other countries to spend and for troops from other countries. In other words, they could undertake a major reassessment of the way we're going about this and de-emphasize the American role, make this less of an American presence in Iraq and make more of the emphasis on it being a world project. That would, of course, entail a certain amount of admission of error, and I don't anticipate that this is high on their agenda. They don't seem to be thinking in this direction. So that would be another way that you would certainly change the message, but I don't necessarily see that happening. The third thing you can do is you can hunker down, say the news is going to get better, we're on the right course, we're going to do what we think is right, and we think that circumstances will begin to respond to our steadfastness more favorably. And I see that as their direction at this time.
Ron Elving, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Neil.
NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. During the news conference today, President Bush was asked who he thought was behind this most recent series of attacks in Iraq.
The Baathists try to create chaos and fear because they realize that a free Iraq will deny them the excessive privileges they had under Saddam Hussein. The foreign terrorists are trying to create conditions of fear and retreat because they fear a free and peaceful state in the midst of a part of the world where terror has found recruits, that freedom is exactly what terrorists fear the most.
The relentless violence in Iraq has shaken many there and has blunted the administration's effort to emphasize positive development. Later in this program, we'll look at the stakes next Tuesday in the off-year elections, but first, what's going on in Iraq, who's behind it, and the best way to eliminate it. If you have questions about the news from Iraq, you can call us. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, the address TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now are Magnus Ransdorp. He's a director at the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Good of you to join us today, sir.
Pleasure to be with you.
And with us here in Studio 3A is Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America, which was just released in paperback with a new chapter on the War on Terror. And good of you to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
How accurate do you think, and we'll start with you, Magnus Ransdorp, how accurate do you think the president's assessment of who's behind the violence is?
I think it's very accurate. It's very difficult to discern in this sort of chaos, or should we say somewhat of a chaos that the U.S. troops finds itself in Iraq, particularly around Baghdad. We know that attacks have intensified dramatically, but it is a fusion of a lot of different elements. It is, as the president said, Baathist elements who are pro-Saddam loyalists. I wouldn't sort of be too hung up on that terminology, but certainly there are those that are still fighting, still using their expertise. But in terms of the scale and scope of sophistication, they are relatively low on the scale. We also have foreign elements, and we saw that from the arrest yesterday of a Syrian national. There has been individuals who are part or are working, at least not perhaps for Al-Qaeda, but in the service of Al-Qaeda, who believe in the same ideology. So I think those two things combined really sort of give a good picture. And we have also on top of that tribal element. But I think one thing that President left out in his speech is that there is also an economic crisis within the context of reconstruction. And that economic crisis and the spread of unemployment in trying to make a living has been, of course, exploited because there has been, and I've spoken to a number of people who have been on the ground, who who have been working with demining and the bomb disposal teams. There is also an element of locals actually selling their skill sets, selling explosives to whoever is paying the best price. So I think it's a mixture of all these things.
Daniel Benjamin, the same question to you, and let me throw in one more element, and that is, of course, that yesterday was the first day of Ramadan. Should we ignore that symbolism too?
Well, certainly not. It was well-timed, and for the last 10 years, we've recognized that Ramadan was a period of particular interest and one of high vulnerability, and jihadists in particular have liked to operate around that time. It is certainly true that both groups are operating in Iraq. It is unfortunately a sign of our own problems that we don't know who's behind the particular attacks, and an indication of this was that within 24 hours we had two brigadier generals contradicting each other on who was behind the most recent wave of attacks. But a few things I think are clear. One of them is that the trend line points towards an increasing number of jihadist fighters coming from outside the country into the country to carry out attacks. Certainly the suicide bombings that we saw yesterday suggest from the perspective of tradecraft that they were involved.
Very different from the Sunday rocket attack on the Al Rashid Hotel, for example.
Very different, requiring more coordination, but even the Al Rashid attack was a pretty impressive piece of trade work, given that there was a fair amount of technical innovation that was required there. I think that one other thing that needs to be said is that it's quite likely that these two groups are working together. All the reasons why they wouldn't work together before the invasion of Iraq have evaporated. There's an enormous amount of ordnance in the country, and therefore a lot of material with which to carry out terrorist attacks.
During his news conference today, Magnus Ransdorp, the president said that there is more work going on to try to patrol the borders of Iraq, but clearly they're quite porous. What more can be done?
Well, it's very difficult, I would have to say that beyond the ideological rhetoric that one may suspect of the hostility towards Iran and Syria, there is a great degree of truth to the porous nature of both of those borders. On the Syrian front, it is actually one of the only open borders in the sense of being porous. There are only few nodes in which some of these foreign jihadists can actually enter into Iraq. Those that certainly don't get any visa into going to Iran would certainly go through Lebanon, through Syria, and into Iraq and join up. Then you have another element, and that is actually going through Iran, and they are coming from Afghanistan, Pakistan, but particularly Pakistan, and they are entering into Iran. And then they are given sort of safe passage to go into Iraq to inflict damage.
Daniel Benjamin, what do we read into the targets? Obviously, Iraqi police stations, and yesterday, the headquarters of the International Red Cross, Red Crescent, an unlikely target, it would seem.
Well, not really. Any NGO that is involved in any way in maintaining order in Iraq right now is going to be a natural target for either Baathists or jihadists. We've seen a whole series of targets, in fact, which could have been aimed at by either group, whether it's the Jordanian embassy, the UN headquarters. All of these are, if you will, overdetermined targets. There are plenty of people who would like to take them out, and I put the Red Crescent in the same category. Anything that has an international dimension like that and is in some way involved in upholding the status quo is a legitimate target for these operators.
We're talking about the ongoing violence in Iraq. When we come back, we'll take your calls and talk more about the best way that people have suggested that it might be brought to an end as quickly as possible. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the ongoing struggle for stability in Iraq, what some have characterized as the race between resistance and reconstruction. You're, of course, invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, the email address toTN@npr.org. Our guests are Magnus Ransdorp of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and Daniel Benjamin of the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. And let's get a caller on the line. Steve joins us on the line from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Thank you for taking my call, Neil.
Sure.
I think there are three points to be made here, and I'll make them really quickly. In terms of the sources of the resistance, the Iraqi resistance, the occupation by the United States, I think, first of all, this is very different from Vietnam, where there were jungles to hide in.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about an urban resistance, and there's no way that urban resistance can be coordinated so well without support from the local population. Number two, there's probably a fair degree, if not a high degree, of infiltration of American, of the Iraqi police, and even of American intelligence, by virtue of the fact that there's a lot of anger in Iraq on the part of the people to the, never-ending, killings by the Americans of civilians in Baghdad and in Fallujah. You just think that today's target was the Fallujah police station. Of course, the police themselves have been attacked by the American forces in Fallujah. So that's number two. And, of course, during resistance to occupation, historically, anti-resistance groups have historically infiltrated the intelligence services of the occupiers. And finally, just number three, a real short point, I think it would be nice for the National Public Radio audience to also hear the perspective of an opponent of the occupation in addition to two people who support the occupation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Magnus Ransdorp, in terms of the infiltration of intelligence, presumably Steve was talking about things like translators and that sort of thing. Is that a likely prospect, and is that something that's to be worried about?
Well, I mean, it's a very difficult environment to operate in because the line of loyalty and allegiance, I think the caller was talking about this really in his first question, and
mm-hmm.
that was the importance of honor and dignity, the importance of land. You know, we look at this conflict through the cultural prism of the West. We're dealing with an Arab society, Arab culture, and I think, and I'm speaking here from a British perspective, over the last sort of few weeks, we've had a lot of documentaries that have really illustrated the difficulty for the US forces to be able to operate in this environment, not speaking the language, not knowing the culture, it's a sharp learning curve, and everyone is, you know, has to be regarded as an enemy if you don't understand the nature of the environment you're operating in. It's not a major criticism against the U.S. military, but certainly, you know, having culturally sensitive policing is absolutely essential for a culture that revolves around honor, revolves around dignity, revolves around also blood feuds. And I think that, you know, there may be some instances where there have been attacks against U.S. troops, where there have been individuals being killed. And of course, the tribe, the clan structure that exists there is absolutely critical.
We're going to hear more about that in a few minutes. But Daniel Benjamin, what about the first point that was made? I mean, is it possible for these kinds of attacks to go on without considerable popular support for them?
They can go on for a while. And over the long term, if the terrorists themselves are living in these communities, then intelligence methods will determine that. But there can be an awful lot of mayhem before you get to that point. And it's also the case the terrorists coming in from the outside can cause a lot of problems without ever having really plugged into the local infrastructure. Remember, it's still, compared to some of the other counterinsurgencies that we've been involved with, quite early days. But what is also true is that we face a problem because support for the U.S. Occupation, while still significant, and most of the polls suggest it's in the middle 60 percent range.
You're talking about polls of Iraqis here.
Correct. Nonetheless, that's down from what it was a few months ago. And I think most experts would agree that the window of opportunity is closing faster than we would like, and there may be no more than six more months in which we need to get the security situation under control, or Iraqis' patience will be, I think, exhausted.
Among those measuring how quickly reconstruction is going is Julia Taft, who's director of the United Nations Development Program's Bureau for Crisis Prevention and Recovery. She joins us now from her office in New York City. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us briefly what reconstruction has been taking place so far in Iraq?
Well, most of the reconstruction is not technically long-term reconstruction. It's mostly repair of facilities and expanding some of the capacity for electricity and water purification and sewage treatment. But it's mostly repairing existing systems with up to the capacity that preceded the war. Reconstruction really means a major investment in expanding power grids, expanding the lifelines, the roads, the water treatment, and this, of course, was the topic of much of the reconstruction conference last week in Madrid.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a degree to which the resistance is combating the reconstruction in terms of knocking down electrical towers as soon as they're put up or blowing up pipelines?
Oh, this is a real problem. I mean, I don't think anybody expected that there would be this kind of widespread destruction. However, it's our understanding that many of the facilities are now being guarded, and yet the real reconstruction can only take place when there's an improved security environment.
After the attack on UN headquarters, much of that staff was withdrawn. How does the United Nations decide, when an area is secure enough? What sort of parameters do you think about?
Well, we have a number of criteria for when we can have staff present and operating. We have minimum operating standards in terms of vehicles, sites, the gear people have, the communications capacity they have. Right now, in Baghdad, we only have a very small number of people staying in the grounds of the Canal Hotel in a more fortified position. But, you know, that's not really the long-term solution here, because the UN agencies are used to working among communities and being out and about and having large numbers of people coming in and visit and working with a variety of the civil society and government. You can't really do that if you're not very mobile, and that's our biggest problem right now. We do, however, have 4,000 local staff throughout the country who are maintaining a presence, who are maintaining the school systems and the feeding programs and the electricity that we've been providing. But they're doing this also at some risk to themselves.
Julia Taft, thanks very much. I know you're busy today. We appreciate your giving us the time.
Thank you.
Julia Taft is director of the United Nations Bureau for Crisis Prevention and Recovery. She joined us from her office in New York City. And let's get another caller on the line. Mark is with us from Baltimore.
Hey, thanks a lot. During the course of the discussion today, and also I watched the president's news conference, most of it, and I noticed that neither today nor in the president's remarks was any comment or suggestion made that Saddam Hussein might be somehow coordinating some of these attacks. And I'm just wondering, whether or not any of your experts there think that it's a possibility, and whether or not they've heard anything about where his location, what his location might be, and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Thank you.
Daniel Benjamin, why don't you take a shot at that?
Well, the short answer is no one knows where he is, and if we did, we'd have found him by now. I think it is entirely possible that he has nothing to do with the attacks themselves, that his day is completely taken up with personal security issues. But it is also quite likely that many of his former aides, the ones who haven't been caught, or mid-level supporters, are deeply involved. The point is that the Ba'ath Party was primed to do this kind of resistance well before the invasion and had the mindset and, it seems to a certain extent, the prepared resources for conducting such a campaign.
Magnus Ransdorp, let me ask you the same question and add, obviously the United States brings a lot of technological expertise to this. Isn't it difficult to coordinate activities if you're fearful of intercepted radio communications or phone conversations?
Well, obviously, operational security is very difficult in this environment, as I was explaining before, about operating in where everyone essentially must be regarded as your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this, that what I've heard on the ground is that there have been elements who have been watching U.S. Sort of force protection procedures in order to gauge, you know, any potential weaknesses. Obviously, it's very difficult to operate against an adversary that continuously hides among the population. But I think in general, it is an incredibly difficult intelligence environment, particularly because it is, you know, you have to harness the local community, local population for information. Apart from the special operations, and apart from this sort of high-grade intelligence that is flowing in, so it is an incredibly difficult environment.
Daniel Benjamin, there obviously, as the caller mentioned, there has been a lot less effort, a lot less mention of the capture of Saddam Hussein. Would that be an important contribution at this point?
It would certainly take some of the steam out of the opposition, and it would be a huge public relations coup for the United States. I think it's getting mentioned less because it's taken so long and it's very difficult to do. It's actually very hard to find an individual. But at the same time, as I mentioned before, the tendency, it appears, is for more and more outside fighters to be coming into the country, and they will continue the fight regardless of whether or not Saddam is found. And they pose a very significant long-term threat to stability in the region. Julia Taft was talking before about the problems of getting to long-term significant reconstruction. You know, as long as our forces are first and foremost concerned with security and they're in body armor and our officials can't get out and about and work in the way that they need to with the population there, we will have a really difficult time getting on with the reconstruction in a way that we need to satisfy the desires of the Iraqi people.
And those soldiers are also likely to be extremely jumpy, and as has been pointed out, there have been an awful lot of Iraqi civilians killed, some in incidents, but some by accident, and that certainly doesn't help.
No, it's a classic problem when you have an occupation and when you have an insurgency going on. Nervous soldiers, understandably nervous, may react too quickly, and the result is a tragedy for both sides.
We're speaking about the situation in Iraq after the most recent spate of bloody attacks there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. At the president's news conference today, he spoke about how to deal with ongoing violence in Iraq.
We got to make sure that that not only we harden targets, but that we get actionable intelligence to intercept the missions before they begin. That means more Iraqis involved in the intelligence gathering systems in their country so that they are active participants in securing the country from further harm.
For a look at a possible solution to some of the problems in Iraq, we're joined now by Amatzia Baram, a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace here in Washington. He's with us from his office there. Mr. Baram published an op-ed in today's New York Times outlining one idea of how to deal with Iraq entitled Victory in Iraq, One Tribe at a Time. And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Baram, and first of all, welcome. What did you make of Mr. Bush's assessment there?
Well, the situation is very complicated. It's complicated because, on the one hand, things are getting much, much better, and fairly quickly, too. And the CPA is doing an excellent job. On the other hand, things are getting worse. Security issues are getting worse. Development is getting better, but it cannot go on for very long because eventually development will depend on security. So, I mean, it depends on what you look at, the half empty or half full glass. but if there is no reduction in terrorist activities, and by the way, I don't think this is really resistance, or in French, résistance. As the French were making sure that French people won't get hurt, and these people are just terrorists. But in any case, I don't think that if this goes on, then development will succeed as well.
In your op-ed article, you suggested that the United States provide a lot more attention to the tribes in Iraq. It's almost sort of a parallel political structure that went along with the Ba'ath Party, and a very important one. What do you think the U.S. does not understand about this tribal structure?
Well, maybe they understand, but until now they were busy with other things, which I believe to be extremely important. And anyway, with the tribes in the Shi'i South, they managed very well. With the tribes in the Sunni Arab Triangle, north and west of Baghdad, I think they didn't manage to do very much. And this can be done, should be done, and I think it will reduce the amount of support for terrorist activities. The basic idea is to approach them tribe by tribe, or tribal group by tribal group, to identify the sheikhs, the real centers of gravity in the tribe, and offer them all sorts of perks which they cannot get otherwise, and that can be very, very important for the tribe. And if a tribal sheikh does not want to cooperate, you turn to somebody else who is his competitor. In every tribe, you have competition to the sheikh, and you offer him, and through him, the tribe will get the services, and he'll become eventually the sheikh. So that's a kind of thing that requires a lot of local knowledge. And so far, you simply because you were busy with other things, you haven't been doing very much on that front.
Wouldn't that encourage the kind of warlordism that we've seen, for example, in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. This is a downside, and I agree 100%. I mean, I think there is an American saying, there is no such thing as a free lunch. But what I'm trying to argue in my article, and that's really my view since years, Iraq is different from Afghanistan. You don't have those formidable mountainous areas that you cannot penetrate, impenetrable. It's a flatland, especially this area, the upper Euphrates and the upper Tigris. That's a, you know, rolling hills, flat area, very easy to get, very accessible. So that's number one. Number two, in Afghanistan, the government will never have the kind of perks an Iraqi government will be able to offer its tribesmen. So I would say, well, yes, there is a little bit of sort of deviation here from the ideal course of civil society, but it's not a great deviation. And anyway, first of all, many tribal sheikhs are themselves intellectuals, academics, and professionals. And second of all, let's not forget, tribal values, tribal organizations, tribal affinities in the Iraqi countryside are a part of the Iraqi social structure.
Amatzia Baram, thank you very much.
You are most welcome.
Amatzia Baram of the U.S. Institute for Peace. We'll continue our conversation on Iraq after a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today on Talk of the Nation, we're discussing ways to help create security in Iraq. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about Election Day one week from today with Ken Rudin. But first, we're going to go back to our guest, Daniel Benjamin of the Center for the Study of International Security, and Magnus Ransdorp of the Center for the Study of Terrorism. And let's get another caller on the line. And Kathleen is with us in Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for getting me on. But earlier guest, Julia Taft, stated that no one knew that the destruction would be so great. And I myself heard Madeleine Albright, Jimmy Carter, Robert McNamara, Gerald Schwarzkopf, General Zinni, all warn against the U.S. acting unilaterally. I wanted to ask your guest whether they think the degree of resistance would be so great if the U.S. had coordinated and cooperated with the U.N. and had built a greater coalition before any action was taken.
Magnus Ransdorp, would that political element have changed things in Iraq?
Very difficult to say. It's easy to be wise in hindsight. I think it may have helped. I mean, you know, you have to really look at the environment. I mean, it came during the war on terrorism. It was a logical extension. It was mixed in with the war on terrorism, the regime change in Iraq and WMD. It's possible that that it could have been mitigated, but unfortunately today, in today's world, we are we are faced with the fact that the United States is a hyperpower and that it is having to be more proactive and more engaging in this affair. So I don't think that it would have significantly, because there would have been a U.S. element possibly involved in tackling the issue.
What about you, Daniel Benjamin? Would this have ameliorated the situation if a coalition had been developed through the UN structure?
I think it certainly would have made things easier on the United States if we could have spread out the burden to a number of other countries. And I think that at the margins, it might have made some difference with the Iraqi population, in the sense that they would recognize that there was a broader base of legitimacy to the action. And there might have been a longer period in which we had to operate. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that outsiders, for example, jihadists, would have viewed the occupation as illegitimate no matter who was involved, and everyone involved in the occupation would have been a target. And the hardcore Baathists would have also continued to attack us and anyone else who was in the country. There would have been very important benefits in international diplomacy had we had a broader mandate and more international support. There's no question about that. I'm not sure that the security situation would have been hugely different, though.
Kathleen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and one final question to you both, and that is we've heard calls earlier in the occupation that there weren't enough American forces in Iraq, that perhaps the security situation would be much better if there were more troops there. We've also heard the president most recently emphasize in his speech, his news conference rather, earlier today, the necessity to train more Iraqi policemen and eventually an Iraqi army as well. Magnus Ransdorp, where do you think the effort needs to be?
Well, let me tell you, I'm very happy that you had Amatzia Biram on because he has really pinpointed something that has been completely absent. One should not underestimate the ideas that he was advancing. The idea of buying off tribes is a fantastic one, and I think that he has been present. I think much more work needs to be done on this front in identifying key individuals who can assist us in not only flushing out, but also preserving the security environment. And that goes hand in hand with developing the police structure, of creating a multi-ethnic, multicultural police structure that will of course, assist the United States. I'm not sure in terms of the troop level. I think that the issue of the tribe and tackling that issue, combined with the necessity, and more also, you know, obviously, like what we learned, for example, in Northern Ireland, but it's not as complex situation, is to you have to harness the local community. You have to find the means and mechanisms to do that effectively. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the United States is right now basically sitting ducks for jihadists as well as Baathists.
Daniel Benjamin?
Well, a few points. Of course, Amatzia Biram is correct that in any occupation, you need to find the key elements in the society and incorporate them into your strategy just as quickly as possible. So I agree about that. I agree that over the long term, this is an Iraqi problem. They're going to have to step up and show that they are not going to succumb to terrorist violence. But at the same time, we simply haven't had enough troops on the ground. If we had, as Secretary Rumsfeld used to like to say, flooded the zone very early on, we would have done a better job in securing the enormous armaments caches that are in Iraq. And there was a woeful underestimation of the amount of loose ordnance there. We would have done a better job on border patrols. And simply having so many people on the ground would have had an inhibiting factor, I think. We would have been more capable of following up and tracking those who had attacked us. At this point, we're in a very, very difficult position because we don't have spare troops. Without drawing down other commitments, I mean, the U.S. military, the U.S. Army in particular, is essentially committed to Iraq for the foreseeable future, and everyone in the military, in the Army, will be spending a lot of time there for quite a while to come. It would be great if we could find more forces. It would be great if we could find them from some of our partners abroad. But in the near term, that doesn't seem very likely.
Daniel Benjamin is the co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America, just out in paperback. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Magnus Ransdorp, thank you for your time today as well.
Thank you.
Magnus Ransdorp is director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He joined us from his office there.